raids upon peaceful and defenseless Arab villages involving murder, torture, rape, and pillage too. Psychological warfare to convince the Arab villagers that the best thing for their safety would be to flee their villages and come back when the hostilities ended. 3. Direct expulsion of village inhabitants by razing their homes and occupying their lands. 4. Destruction of the fabric of Palestinian life by wrecking the economy and denying to the remaining Arabs a source of subsistence. 5. Confiscation of all the property of the refugees and refusing to let many return to their land and homes. The exodus of Palestinian Arabs, both forced and voluntary, began with the publication of the UN Partition Resolution on November 29, 1947, and continued even after the armistice agreements were signed in the summer of 1949. Between 600,000 and 700,000 Palestinian Arabs were evicted or fled from areas that were either allocated to the Jewish state or occupied by Jewish forces during the fighting, and later integrated de facto into Israel. During and after the exodus, every effort was made from the razing of villages to the promulgation of laws to prevent their return. There is overwhelming circumstantial evidence showing that a design was being implemented by the Haganah, and later the IDF, Israel Defense Force, to reduce the number of Arabs in the Jewish state to a minimum, to make use of most of their lands and properties, and to resettle Jewish immigrants on the confiscated lands. As a result, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were intimidated and terrorized and caused to flee in panic. Still others were driven out by the Israeli army, which, under the leadership of Ben-Gurion, planned and executed the expulsion in the wake of the UN partition. The Israeli leadership, including Ben-Gurion, were all of one mind that the Arabs understood only the language of force, and any proposals for compromise would be taken for weakness. They all accepted Ben-Gurion's view that the state of Israel should be demographically homogeneous and geographically as extensive as possible. The Israeli propaganda was also effective as a psychological weapon. The Haganah disseminated leaflets to Arab villages which said, "We have no wish to fight ordinary people who want to live in peace, but only the army and forces which are preparing to invade Palestine. Therefore, all people who do not want this war must leave together with their women and children in order to be safe. This is going to be a cruel war with no mercy or compassion. There is no reason why you should endanger yourselves," emphasis supplied, lest this notice be taken as a compassionate gesture rather than a cynical method of causing evacuation of Arab villages. It is important to know something of what had just happened in the infamous Di Yassin massacre. The following are quotations from Flapen's book. The village of Di Yassin was located in a largely Jewish area in the vicinity of Jerusalem, and had signed a non-aggression pact with its Jewish yet for the entire day of April 9, 1948. Igan and Lehi soldiers carried out the slaughter in a cold and premeditated fashion. In a 1979 article dealing with the later forced evacuation of Lydda and Ramleh, New York Times reporter David Shipler cites Red Cross and British documents to the effect that the attackers lined men, women, and children up against walls and shot them, so that Di Yassin remains a name of infamy in the world. When they had finished, they looted the village and fled. Following this, Menachem Begin sent out an order of the day to his band of terrorists: "Accept my congratulations on this splendid act of conquest. As at Di Yassin, so everywhere we would attack and smite the enemy. God, thou hast chosen us for conquest." The ruthlessness of the attack on Di Yassin shocked Jewish and world public opinion alike, drove fear and panic into the Arab population, and led to the flight of unarmed civilians from their homes all over the country. David Shortchiel, the head of the Haganah in Jerusalem, condemned the massacre of Arab civilians in the sharpest terms. He charged that the splinter groups had not launched a military operation, but had chosen one of the quiet villages in the area that had never been connected with any of the attacks since the start of hostilities. But according to the Igan, Shortchiel had approved of the attack. And years later, the historian of the Haganah, Ariel Yitzhaki, wrote that the operation in Di Yassin was in line with dozens of attacks carried out at that time by the Haganah in Palmach, in the course of which houses full of elderly people, women, and children were blown up. Less well known than Di Yassin, but no less brutal, was the massacre in Duwima, near Hebron, carried out on October 29,1948, by formerly HE members, and revealed by the Israeli journalist Yola Hashifi in 1984. Former mayor of Jerusalem Khaledi called the attack on Di Yassin senseless, especially in view of the pacific nature of the village and its relations with its Jewish neighbors. But from another perspective, it made perfect sense. More panic was sown among the Arab population by this operation than by anything that had happened up to then. Di Yassin is considered by most historians to have been the direct reason for the flight of the Arabs from Haifa on April 21st, and from Jaffa on May 4th. Emphasis supplied, Ben-Gurion made it clear, however, that even though the Arab areas which he considered important to the new state had been brought under Israeli control, there still remained the problem of their inhabitants. On May 11th, he noted in his diary that he had given orders for the destruction of an Arab island in the Jewish populated area. The most significant elimination of these Arab islands took place 2 months after Israel's declaration of independence. In one of the gravest episodes of this tragic story, on July 12 to 13, 1948, as many as 50,000 Arabs were driven out of their homes in Lida and Ramleh. In Lida, the exodus took place on foot. In Ramleh, the IDF provided buses and trucks. Originally, all males had been rounded up and enclosed in a compound, but after some shooting was heard and construed by Ben-Gurion to be the beginning of an Arab Legion counter-offensive, he stopped the arrests and ordered the speedy eviction of all the Arabs, including women, children, and the elderly. In explanation, he said that those who made war on us bear responsibility after their defeat. With the population gone, the Israeli soldiers proceeded to loot the two towns in an outbreak of mass pillaging that the officers could neither prevent nor control. This was not the first time that Israeli soldiers had engaged in looting, nor was looting a problem confined to the army. Jewish civilians also rushed to plunder Arab towns and villages once they were emptied of their inhabitants. Ben-Gurion had shown considerable concern over the phenomenon even before the events at Ramleh and Lida. On June 16, he wrote, "There is a moral defect in our ranks that I never suspected existed. I refer to the mass looting, in which all sections of the population participated. This is not only a moral defect but a grave military defect." 6 weeks earlier, on May 1, Ben-Gurion had noted that, in Haifa, professional thieves took part in the looting initiated by the IGUN, and that booty had also been found in the possession of Haganah commanders. He described other unsavory aspects of the operations as well. There was a search for Arabs, they were seized, beaten, and also tortured in October. He again referred to large-scale looting by the Haganah in Beersheba, which would appear to indicate that his previous exhortations had not been effective. Flappin adds this comment, "His moral revulsion, however, did not lead him either to insist that offenders be brought to trial or to abandon the strategy of evictions." Indeed, very few soldiers and civilians were tried for looting or indiscriminate. Ben-Gurion believed strongly that economic warfare against the Palestinian Arabs would also be an important tactic. This is explained in the inner letter to Sherrod. Ben-Gurion focused on economic issues, observing that the important difference with the riots of 1937 is the increased vulnerability of the Arab urban economy. Haifa and Jaffa are at our mercy. We can starve them out. Motorized transport, which has also become an important factor in their life, is to a large extent at our mercy. The destruction of the Palestinian urban bases, along with the conquest and evacuation, willing or unwilling, of nearby villages, undermined the whole structure of Palestinian life in many parts of the country, especially in the towns. Ben-Gurion's advisors urged closing stores, barring raw materials from factories, and various other measures. Yadin, the army's head of operations, advised that we must paralyze Arab transportation and commerce, and harass them in country and town. This is the way to lower their morale. And Sassen proposed damaging Arab commerce even if Jewish commerce will be damaged. We can tolerate it, they cannot. We must not hit here and there, but at all transportation at once, all commerce and so on. Within weeks, the urban disintegration of the Palestinian Arabs was a fait accompli. Ben-Gurion's tactics had succeeded. As he explained it, the strategic objective of the Jewish forces was to destroy the urban communities, which were the most organized and politically